Our title today is Ecological Revitalization Using Natural Materials. We are presenting this as part of our Kluwen.org mining webinar series, which if you go to the additional resources on the right-hand side of our slide deck today, it will take you to that page and you can look at some archived webinars. This is probably our fourth or fifth webinar that we've had in this series. And we're also conducting this webinar in conjunction with the NARPM Presents series that is done this time of year, every year. So this is one of the webinars that's part of that series also. My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I do work in EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. And I'm going to be moderating today's session. Like I said, we're just going to do a little bit of housekeeping while we're waiting for people to log on. You all should have gotten the seminar-specific URL, which was the front page of today's webinar. There's a lot of useful information on this page. You can see people's bio sketches, their contact information, email addresses of the presenters if you have any questions for them after today's presentation. And those of you who have been going to Kluwen Internet seminars for a while, you've noticed recently that we've moved to using a different delivery platform of this Adobe Connect. With this new tool, our speakers can now move through the material, show videos, and even show live demonstrations to participants. And you'll see one of our presenters will actually show you a video today. Gone are the days that you have to click through the slide yourselves. We appreciate your patience as we're trying out this new tool. We have got a lot of positive feedback, so I think you're going to enjoy today's presentation using Adobe Connect. I do realize that most of you are probably streaming the audio online. However, I know that there are some people using the limited number of phone lines that we have available. We do request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will be having questions and answers submitted via the Adobe Connect room. At which point I can read them aloud to the presenters. So again, please keep us on mute. If you are on the phone line and your phone does not have a mute button, please hit *6 to place your phone on mute. And just don't put us on hold because we don't want any of that background noise to distract us and affect our recording of today's session. So by now, all of you should be in the Adobe Connect meeting room, and you'll see a number of windows or pods within the room, which includes the presentation materials. The slide numbers of the presentation should be available. I am now on slide 2 of our introductory slides, our housekeeping slides. This tool, Adobe Connect, is going to allow participants to view the materials in real time as our presenters present the seminar. You're not required to do any manually advancing through the slides. Instead, just sit back and watch the presentation as conducted by our presenters. If you do have any problems with Adobe Connect, you can download portions of the items covered and follow along manually. But we can't confirm that all portions of the seminar will be available in this manner, so it is best that you're able to follow along in Adobe Connect. And like I mentioned, majority of participants are listening to the audio online through Adobe Connect. Please make sure that your speaker icon is clicked and it appears green, those of you who are streaming the audio online. If you have any problems with the audio, you can check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you're on the phones, you may need to turn off your speakers, or the online audio will give you duplicate broadcasts and a lot of feedback. We're going to be getting questions and answers. We'll have some sessions after each presentation, and you can submit questions at any time throughout the presentation today by using the Q&A pod, which is in the bottom right-hand corner of today's main screen. And those will come in as the presentations are being given, and we can address those at the Q&A period. One thing to note is other participants will not be able to view your questions. They will only be viewed by myself, the host, and I will be reading them aloud. If you do have any technical difficulties, you can also use the Q&A pod to alert us. Please include your telephone number where you can be reached, and we'll try to help you troubleshoot your problem. And with that, I want to just show you one more window on our third slide. And this is just to orient you to the room. You see where you can see your live presentation in this middle part of, or the left-hand side of the screen. You can control the audio up here at the top with that speaker that I mentioned earlier. You can also enlarge your presentation by clicking on full screen, so you'll be able to look at the slides a lot larger. and you won't have to be distracted with the other pods that are in the room. You can submit your questions using this Q&A pod here in the bottom right-hand corner. And I do encourage you to do that as we're going through the presentation so that when we get to the Q&A period, we are ready to go with the presentation, with the questions and answers. So at this point, I think I am about ready to move to our opening remarks. And we have very fortunate to have Harry Compton with us today, who has a lot of experience in doing a lot of the things that you're going to see presented to you and has actually worked on most of the sites that are being presented. Harry is our acting director for EPA's Environmental Response Team, and he's worked there for 28 years. And Harry, I am going to basically turn the floor over to you to give us some opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. Okay, so I want to just start off by just giving some big picture kinds of things, a little bit of historical perspective. Back in 1998, way back when, I was doing engineering things here at the Environmental Response Team and doing all kinds of mostly immobilization things with metal sites, pretty small sites relative to the kinds of sites you're going to see today. And then back about that time, 97, 98, Mike Zimmerman, OSC in Region 8, called me and said, hey, I got this site. And anyway, it turns out to be this huge site with all kinds of logistic problems. Anyway, so you'll hear a lot more about that. But he was looking for a solution, something other than dig a hole. And my point is, having worked there and some really massive sites, wood treater sites in Florida and other places, you know, EPA just can't afford to dig and haul anymore. We just can't do that. And you've got to dig all this stuff up and find repositories, and so we need other solutions. And, you know, these solutions can work very well. We do the right kinds of testing and show that we've dramatically reduced risk, done the right kinds of treatability studies, but they can be extremely engaging and extremely rewarding. You get buy-in from the community, as you'll see, as you'll listen to these folks talk about their sites. The other thing I wanted to mention was that there's something called the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative in headquarters that I think plays an extremely valuable role, and they largely work with the remedial side of the house, but for the most part, they work with the communities and looking at some of these really massive sites and helping them develop a concept on what they would like to see in the future at that site. I mean, clearly not everything's going to be just a box store or anything. And so these folks are great at working with the community as well as yourselves. I think you'll find it extremely valuable when you present some of the concepts about what the site might look at like in the future if you do these soil amendment things and you turn these basically sterile toxic environments into something that's green and growing and sustainable, and that they, the community, are actually part of the solution in one way, shape, or form, whether it be leaf or litter compost or biosolids or whatever, you know, that they're actually part of the solution, and you get a good sense of personal reward when you see them actually happy about the solution and that they're part of the solution. All right, so we're also reducing risk. Now, we're not dropping risk down to zero, but another important concept, or at least for these metal sites in particular, are that the metal is still there. We're not removing it, but we are drastically reducing the bioavailability of these metals. And we've done that through a number of different tests that I'm sure the folks will talk about, you know, eco-risk kinds of measures, human health kinds of measures, and just everyday run-of-the-mill good old engineering tests like multiple extraction procedure and TCLP and SPLP and those kinds of things to show that we can dramatically reduce the risk and exposure to these metals. So we're going to turn these environments into something that can be productive and of value to the community and actually improve community value. The other interesting thing aspect about this soil amendment is that just this last week, you may have read in the CNN or the newspaper that carbon dioxide for the first time has reached 400 parts per million, measurable. That's the highest it's been since for like 800,000 years, I think the scientists said. And it's largely due, of course, due to the post-industrial revolution carbon dioxide production from industry and so on. But the important thing about the soil amendments are, or the organic soil amendments, they sequester a fairly substantial amount of carbon. So you could even look at it from the global perspective of, you know, you're reducing the potential impact by sequestering some fairly significant quantities of carbon. Now, I've had the pleasure of working with Rufus for many years, and Rufus, I had just engaged in an IA with Rufus Cheney and USDA when Mike Zimmerman asked me that question way back when. And so it was like a harmonic convergence of all these ideas all at once. So it was, we worked with Rufus and one of his students at the time, Sally Brown, and came up with a solution for that we think works pretty well out there in Leadville. And then similar with Gary up in Vermont, and not that it was necessarily an infertile environment, but it certainly was toxic, and so he was looking for a solution up there that might be able to work, and he too had a really interesting engagement with the community in pitching some of those ideas. Anyway, I think that's all I have to wrap up or to introduce the whole concept here.
Great.
I think you'll find these talks really engaging.
Great. Thanks, Harry. Yeah, I think your remarks have really set the stage for what we're going to hear from Rufus, Gary, and Mike. So I really appreciate your time, and I'm glad to hear that you can stay on for today's webinar. So if any questions or discussion comes up throughout, please feel free to jump in at any time. So now we're going to get into our presentation portion of today's webinar. And as I mentioned, our first speaker is Dr. Rufus Cheney. He's a senior research scientist with the USDA Agricultural Research Service, which is in Beltsville, Maryland. And Rufus does research on fate, food chain transfer, and potential effects and remediation of hazards from soil microelements. And he has a very interesting presentation. I think all of you will enjoy it. So at this point, Rufus, I'm going to turn the floor over to you. Let me bring the pointer up for you so it's there when you're ready. So it's all you, Rufus.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle. Okay. As the title says, I'm gonna lay the background for why this system works. What do we address at a toxic site, at a barren Superfund site, and how can we use amendments and what I call agronomy, soil and plant science, to solve these severe barren sites. I'm not moving ahead, Michelle.
Okay, Rufus. If you look in the lower left-hand corner of the Adobe Connect room, there's some arrows.
Okay.
Okay, good. There
gotcha.
You go.
Okay.
Thank you.
The first principle is that we have to take into account the risks. And in practice, although we look at all the possible risks, we're not looking at backyard gardens on these contaminated sites. We're really looking at wildlife exposures, potential soil ingestion risks that we have to look at anywhere, and then the plant toxicity risks, soil and plant toxicity, and then the predators. Of course, the whole practice is to stop erosion and leaching by immobilizing the contaminants. Over the last 30, 40 years, we've found a model that explains most of the transfer of metals and what we can do about them. These are the principles, what I've called the soil-plant barrier in terms of protecting food chains. Nearly all the elements are so insoluble or so strongly adsorbed in the soil that they're not practically taken up. soil ingestion would be the only way you're going to get those elements into a body. And in this list, I've got chromium, titanium, lead, iron, mercury, selenium, and tin, and a whole, you know, nearly all the elements are that insoluble. The second group are elements that are soluble enough that they can be taken up by plants. They're low enough charge, they're 2+ rather than higher charge, and they can reach levels that are toxic to plants. Most of the barren sites are zinc, copper, nickel, or manganese, aluminum toxic, boron toxic, and they may have arsenic issues. There are exceptions to this soil-plant barrier, and there are two kinds. One is to people. It's not really important in the sense that we're not having contaminated rice paddies in the United States. Rice is a unique transfer of soil cadmium. Selenium can poison humans as well, but the main reason that we see adverse effects of selenium, molybdenum, are because in alkaline soils in the western U.S., when they're mineralized by natural processes or pollution, you can have toxic amounts to harm particularly ruminant wildlife who are eating plants out in the field. Both livestock and wildlife, but in the sense of these sites, we're talking about wildlife. The bottom here is the fact that we have to always also be concerned about soil ingestion by wildlife. That's the principal exposure to lead, arsenic, fluoride, and some other elements. So we have to take into account bioavailability of elements in ingested soil. This is a picture of all the processes that are going on with a particular metal in soil. I've shown the element nickel because it represents some of the processes that you would like to know about. One is, of course, that there's a free nickel 2+, and that's the actual form of nickel that's taken up by the roots. That nickel can react with all kinds of surfaces. It can go into new solids, it can be adsorbed, it can be occluded in oxides, adsorbed in oxides, adsorbed on organic matter, adsorbed on soil microbes. It can form chelates with soluble anions and chelating agents, and then it's taken up where it can, if it's high enough, it can harm the plant. On the bottom here, I show LDH, layered double hydroxides. Actually, when you raise the pH of a zinc or nickel or cobalt toxic site, you form whole new compounds of metals that are insoluble and not toxic to plants. And the formation is better and better with time, just like this process over here I called occlusion, where the toxic metal goes inside the iron and manganese oxides. Those metals become less and less available. So even though you can cure the toxicity with the methods I'm going to be talking about in essentially immediately, the cure gets better and better with time. The big idea that we're talking about is also called phytostabilization. That's the process of using soil amendments to reduce the phytotoxicity of soil metals until you no longer have toxicity. One is you need to understand the principles. You have to raise the soil pH so that the metals are so strongly bound or precipitated they're not toxic anymore. I recommend making soils calcareous with extra lime beyond the amount of lime needed to take them to pH 7. That gives you a buffer against future acid rainfall. On the other hand, sometimes soils are so low in manganese that if you make it calcareous, you can induce manganese deficiency. We had that happen at a site up in Ontario, Canada, where the soil was naturally low in manganese, but it was so high in nickel, we had to make it calcareous to stop the toxicity. In that case, we added manganese fertilizer, and that made it absolutely fertile with manganese and absolutely non-toxic regarding the nickel in that case. Same thing would happen all over the east coast and southeast where you have coastal plain soils that are susceptible to manganese deficiency. Sometimes we recommend, if you can find it, low contaminant level iron and manganese oxides to be mixed with the organic amendments to provide a super remediating amendment. It gives even more adsorption than the organic matter and that the natural soil materials could do. So those are the big ideas. We use natural amendments that I'll talk about in a minute about fertilizer value, organic carbon, microbial inoculum, and then we can also add iron and manganese to that by choosing what we make. I've called those mixtures tailor-made phytostabilization mixtures. One looks around the community, finds limestone-rich byproduct materials. You may find biosolids, biosolids compost, manure compost, yard debris compost. In another case, we found wood ash, sugar beet lime. All kinds of materials are available within 20 to 50 miles of every site that we've looked at. And it's a matter of applying your local creativity to find those materials and then make mixtures. Sometimes it's better to have a compost than an undigested or uncomposted organic amendment. And again, I mentioned that occlusion gets better and better with time, like formation of those layered double hydroxides, to where you no longer have any potential harm in the long-term future. Besides the points I've made here, you have to remember that these barren sites that we're going to show you pictures of are so deficient in organic matter and so toxic that the soil microbes have been killed too. Soil microbes require fertility and require organic matter to eat, to live on. And you got no plants growing there. There's nothing for the microbes to live on. They may be almost sterile in terms of microbial constant levels. So we need organic amendment to recreate the fertility aspects of the organic matter to feed the microbes and the microbes to do the transformations in the soil nutrients to allow plants to keep growing. Although I'm not going to spend time showing you about how high phosphate containing manure and biosolids amendments make lead into pyromorphite and make it not bioavailable, that's been in other webinars in this series. What we've been able to show is that by using this method, this phytostabilization approach, we can make it so that it's safe for all wildlife, soil organisms, and plants. The goal is to make it so that diverse plants can live there, not just metal-tolerant plants. So it's the next important agronomic thing is working with the natural resources, USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service, and local experts to find the plants that are best for the particular site you're trying to remediate. And I'll just stress again what Michelle has mentioned many times. When you go to one of these barren sites that's been eroded so there's hardly any soil left in the whole profile, it's not ecosystem restoration, it's revitalization. We can convert a dead, barren waste material into a living soil that supports at least bushes and shrubs and grasses and legumes instead of nothing at all. It may not get trees again because they require deeper rooting, but we're able to give an effective vegetative cover. I'm going to start with a few with some examples. One of the best examples of how this works and has worked is Palmerton, Pennsylvania Superfund site. This is a picture taken in 1980, but just before this smelter was closed. I'm looking down Blue Mountain from where the Appalachian Trail is on top of this Blue Mountain, and 800 acres was absolutely dead near the smelter. 3,000 acres were injured badly enough. There's no debate about the fact that it was severely harmed by the pollution. As a matter of fact, in the village, the soils were so toxic, people gave up trying to grow grass. That's how frustrating it was. I was called in initially because horses had died. Young horses are much more susceptible to zinc toxicity. And while the smelter was operating, plants had twice as much zinc as they would if they were being killed by zinc in the soil. That's because of deposition from the smelter exhaust. So their mother's milk was extremely high in zinc, and they had zinc-induced copper deficiency, and they died. This brought a number of agencies to visit. Eventually, they closed. It became a Superfund site, and the remediation is still ongoing. So we looked at the site, and we had a chance to put in some test plots. In a series of events, the company involved tried to seed a metal-tolerant grass. This is Merlin Red Fescue, selected in England on a zinc mine waste, very old site, where this natural population of red fescue evolved to be extremely zinc-tolerant. So they seeded up here on this plateau, and with leaching of some with limestone and fertilizer and movement of the grass seed, it slowly crept out. But you see, it's not a heavy cover, because still they didn't fix the toxicity. It's still extremely toxic. Now, when they mixed a mixture of biosolids, fly ash, and limestone together and seeded it with Merlin red fescue, there's a lush growth of this plant. Right beside it is the control without the amendment with the seed, and there's just plain nothing growing there because this is extremely toxic. So this was the first demonstration after a greenhouse experiment that you could readily revegetate with a metal-tolerant grass. To give you an idea, some of those soils on the mountainside were 4%, 44,000 ppm zinc, and high in other metals. And pH of these extremely high metal soils was pH 6 because the metal oxides that fell out were limestone-like. The natural mountain soils are pH about 4. And so if you even have 1,000 ppm of pH 4, it's severely toxic. So these extremely contaminated areas, even though they were pH 6, are too toxic for plants. The company went ahead and treated land they owned, about 800 acres, with this mixture. And this is about 20 years later after they'd done their treatment. You'll see bushes. You'll see this wheatgrass. You'll see in the next picture, Lespediza, a legume is thriving on that mountainside. There's so many volunteer plants there now that you wouldn't suspect that it's a toxic site. And as one of Harry's scientists, Mark Springer, showed, the small mammals are so dense that there's a raptor population which has developed. It's cured of its toxicity. But the areas that the company didn't treat remained barren. Here's the other side of the valley in the 98, and it's still that bad today because nobody's taken that site on. Here's the edge of the company land with two people that were important in developing these ideas. On the right is John Euler, who worked for the company. On the left is Tom Studzinski, my colleague in Poland, where I'm going to show you some of their work in a few minutes. Again, on the north side of the valley, huge areas remained barren even when it was greened in the area. And then here's one of the fun parts. At the top is the Appalachian Trail Way, and the National Park Service insisted that no biosolids be placed within 100 meters or 100 yards of the trail. So we have a perfect control of still barren soil at the top, along with this very effective plant cover on the rest of the mountain below the trail. So let's step back now and look at how does one go about figuring out what to do. First, you have to analyze total metals, standard EPA methods. Then you need to measure water-soluble metals, either calcium nitrate, strontium nitrate extractable, water-soluble, displaced soil solution, something that says how soluble they are. The soils that are strongly acidic are going to have huge amounts of soluble metals, and it's going to show you that until you fix that, it's not going to grow. You need to apply a soil fertility test. It could be whatever your state government is using to advise farmers. But you need to know phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium. Acid soils, extremely acid soils that are leached, are going to be low in all of those. Calcium and magnesium can be applied with dolomitic limestone, but you've got to add potassium. That'll come in your compost. And P, phosphorus, will come with biosolids or manure compost. And that's part of why we like those so much, is that they're a complete soil amendment to remediate the infertility of a toxic site. The organic matter is needed to feed the microbes and to improve the soil environment for plant roots growth and survival and effectiveness. And also, again, to support the soil microbes, because without microbes, the nutrients aren't turned over. I like plant available metal tests that use 0.01 molar calcium or strontium nitrate. We can interpret those. Using an acid extraction does not give you plant available. It gives you potential available for deficient interpretation, not for toxic. For toxic interpretation, you need essentially a water-type extraction. The soluble metals are the toxic form, not the adsorbed or precipitated metals. I like to use, among other things, the standard DHPA-TEA soil test. It ordinarily uses 10 grams per 20 milliliters of that solution, but that means that if the DHPA was saturated with zinc, it'd only be 318 ppm. When I got 44,000, obviously I'm going to saturate that chelate with the four, so it's not going to extract anywhere near what's available in the soil. So what we did was we went to a 1 to 50, 1 gram to 50 milliliters for the most contaminated soils in order to get a valid extraction of the plant available pool of metals. It's not the water-soluble toxic form, but it's the pool that's in a chemical form possible to dissolve. Okay, then I have this example from the Palmerton site that we tested in town to test grasses. Again, this is like people's lawns in much of the borough. There's 1.5% zinc, 160 ppm cadmium, 600-700 ppm lead, very high DHPA cadmium and lead, very, very high. But you'll see that even though I tried treatments of limestone or compost with limestone in it, I didn't change the DHPA extractable because that's still in an exchangeable or labile form. But I'll just jump to this. What you do, if you look at strontium nitrate, when I put on the compost with lime in it and iron oxide, I went from 200 milligrams per kilogram of water extractable zinc, of strontium nitrate extractable zinc, to 5. Cadmium went from 2 to 0.03 milligrams per liter, or milligrams per kilogram of the strontium nitrate extractable. You see that we increased the pH, increased the organic matter, increased the iron, the so-called oxalate extractable, or amorphous, or high surface area iron. Here's the field test plot area with my colleagues Yin Lee and Bev Kirshner. And this is a later, 2 or 3 years into the study. Let's see, I lost my arrow. My arrow is here. You'll see here two treatments, the control. And in the control, the only thing which is alive is this Merlin red fescue. Tall fescue is dead. Back here with the compost that had lime and iron in the compost, even the Kentucky bluegrass was green. The tall fescue was thriving, and the Merlin was thriving. Everything was growing very well where we applied the compost. Even with the limestone at 6.5, none of the normal grasses survived. I'm going to skip this. It's just saying that zinc content killed the plant. It was obvious that's what killed it. But with the treatment with the compost, we reduced the zinc content to where it was no longer hazardous. This I took in 2008 on the top where the blue, where the Appalachian Trail is. Still just as barren as ever. Here's another look in the farm gland in the background. Actually, we worked with a farmer. The farmer's making a good living by following our principles of adding enough limestone and keeping the fertility so that he can grow any of the plants he wants to grow. If he let that pH fall to below 5, he'd have nothing growing at all on his farm. So barren as can be, tree seedlings are being killed. We did a paper last year that shows that as soil zinc increases, the number of seedling stems in the forested area on the south side, over the mountaintop, declines. As you get to higher and higher zinc, there's almost no new seedlings growing. We see this as evidence of the future harm if we don't take care of these sites. Acid rainfall will continuously acidify this and make the zinc more plant available. You'll reach a period where it kills all new seedlings because their roots are in the near surface, and it'll then eventually kill even the existing large trees. So that we can't ignore the areas that look alive now that were polluted to high levels. This is a new principle that's not yet taken into account in many of our programs. So to summarize the big ideas again, the problems, a barren metal site almost invariably has low pH due to oxidation of pyrites. In the western areas, we know so many locations, of course, all the coal mine waste, where pyrite oxidized acid then, but they were only aluminum and manganese. They weren't zinc and copper and other toxicities. These sites are simultaneously, because of disturbed mine waste or eroded metal toxic soils, they're deficient in phosphorus, nitrogen, and maybe other nutrients. They may benefit by adding iron. If they're rich in pyrite, they don't need added iron. But other mine waste may need iron to both bind metals and to be more available iron for plants. And as I said repeatedly, organic matter and the microbes in a compost or manure or biosolids is absolutely needed to bring these soils back to life. If you don't add living organisms, they'll blow in with the wind over decades, and it will become covered with, if you reduce the toxicity, it will have microbes. But if you use an inoculum, it goes a lot better. I've said it before, we need to make these soils calcareous using whatever inexpensive limestone we can use. We need to use excess limestone to prevent future drop in pH. We need to add enough limestone to neutralize any remaining pyrite. There's ways to measure remaining pyrite. By doing that, we increase metal absorption remarkably by just raising the pH. And in some cases, by adding an iron-rich, manganese-rich byproduct and phosphate along with our overall remediation amendment, we can greatly improve the fixation of metals. One of the biggest goals is making sure the site is so non-toxic that legumes can thrive. One of the biggest problems with the idea of metal-tolerant plants is that there were no known metal-tolerant legumes. If you don't have a legume, you're going to have to fertilize the site with nitrogen every year forever. That's not a sustainable solution. We need to allow legumes to grow, and of course we've made that work everywhere we've done these. The solutions I've talked about, again, cadmium zinc ratio protection, high pH, reducing bioavailability with phosphate and pH, getting the plant cover that reduces soil ingestion by wildlife and so on, and then organic matter, as Harry said, in carbon storage, sequestration. When you start with zero organic matter, you have a big increase, a big storage. The organic matter increases water infiltration, reduces erosion, and of course we're trying to stop erosion by using these things. You can use your imagination and find almost anything that when mixed together in compost, it makes extremely effective remediation amendment. I've stressed the compost, manures, biosolids, a number of other food processing waste materials, crop residues, all kinds of materials, wood production waste, yard, just on and on. It's really using your imagination. In the site that Gary Lipson is going to talk about, we used a gypsum. It could be the fluidized gas desulfurization gypsum. That would be a great source of calcium for his kind of site. And we use your imagination to find limestone equivalent materials. You mix them together, apply them across the top, and I'll show you some ideas about that, and then you've done a one-shot, does-the-whole-job remediation, revitalization, that allows you to get the vegetation. I've said those things. One of the benefits of mixing organic matter and limestone equivalent is that you can actually move alkalinity down the soil. This is the initial pH of this sandy soil. We have put a biosolids compost mixed into the surface. You see that it raised the pH down a meter in the soil. We did that with other tests. Here was the initial soil pH. Here's with a high lime biosolid material tilled into the top 15-20 centimeters. So that this is one of the few ways science has found to influence the pH of the subsurface. This has allowed us to use surface application in sites that are not so severely toxic or so severely acidic. I can't do that with the site that Zimmerman's going to talk about, because that was up to 3 feet deep of pH 2.5. I can't solve that with this leachable alkalinity idea, but I can solve the Bunker Hill site that I'm going to show you next. And again, local creativity. Any one of you who's working on a local site can find these resources and do the job. Here was the next site we worked with after Poland, and that was the Bunker Hill, Kellogg, Idaho Superfund site. We did that one before the one that Mike Zimmerman is going to talk about. This is a 3,000-acre site. This mountain here was terraced in 1970. It was remaining barren in the late 90s when we came there to establish plots. The device up here is a arrow spreader mounted on a chassis so they can spread the amendments that we were testing on this mountainside. Here's the arrow spreader throwing a semi-solid mixture of biosolids, wood ash, and log yard debris mixed together, just front-end loader mixed together, and then thrown on top of the soil. The soil was about 1% zinc, about pH 6.5, but it was barren and had been barren for decades. The foreground is the control, no amendment but seeded. Here's the amendment plus seeding on top, lush vegetative cover. The same thing was done on the mountainside. You can see the treated area and the control. It is night and day, and it is just as simple as I'm showing the work that we developed, again, with Dr. Sally Brown and Chuck Henry and the team that did this work. Next thing I'm going to talk about is a site also at Kellogg, Idaho, where they had made a pond area they wanted to make a wetland out of mine waste. A lead risk to migratory birds was a serious problem in this area. There were no vegetative cover, or hardly any, and so what we ended up doing was applying 6 inches of compost on top of the mine waste. 6 inches because there's a plant called arrowroot that is a natural colonizer in this area that's eaten by migratory waterfowl. It's down 8 inches, and if they get 8 inches into the mine waste, or 6 inches into the mine waste, they're going to get poisoned by the lead. So we applied that, and this is the before, and this is the after. Lushly vegetated with no further risk to the migratory waterfowl. This site, the zinc was so toxic in this pH 2.5 mine waste site that even when you flooded it, it did not become reducing because the bugs and the organic matter needed for them to get energy to make it anaerobic were not present. They couldn't make it anaerobic because it was so toxic. As soon as we added the remediation mixture of limestone equivalent and biosolids, it was immediately reducing, converted the lead to lead sulfide, and was not bioavailable. So I'm quickly going to tell you about a site, actually the site that we treated before we began at the large work at Palmerton. And this is the one that after we'd done this, it came to Harry Compton's attention. After the demise of communism, EPA was helping in Poland to deal with contaminated sites and the storage tanks and everything else to help them develop hazardous waste systems. Ken Pantuck, a Region 3 scientist, had worked with biosolids with us at Beltsville before, He came to see me. I went to see Lee Daniels, a remediation scientist for coal mines, but very knowledgeable soil plant scientist. And then we found a colleague of mine, Tom Szczesinski and Greg Siebelek, at a IUNG, an institute that deals with soil fertility in Poland, one of the leading soil remediation groups and toxicity groups in Poland. Here's a site that they had to deal with. It was a smelter slag, extremely toxic. This again, has been barren, just like all the sites we talked about. You don't do anything with a site like this, it stays barren just about forever. We put in plots with an alternate limestone. This was a limestone waste product from producing acetylene gas. We applied in different plots, we applied biosolids and limestone to make different treatments, seeded it with a group of plants that were believed to be metal tolerant or resistant or to do well at that site if it was made non-toxic. You see, this looks uneven. Well, the uneven is the between the plots where we didn't treat it. Where we treated it, particularly where we used the higher rates that we recommend, we had excellent vegetation. And you go a couple years later and you have persistent vegetation. This is another site where it was a mine waste rather than a smelter slag. Again, you see the control and the treated night and day. This has come back now just a couple years ago, 2009. You can see again where the plots were. We have vegetation still 10 years later, 15 years later. And in between where we had our aisles between plots, we still have barren stuff. If you look at the from the side view, we again have some that are very good and barren. Here's the big story. The absolute edge of these sites is always still absolutely barren. If you do simple treatments, waste limestone, organic amendments, fertilizer consideration, apply it, mix it in the surface with the simplest tools that you use in agriculture, sprinkle reasonable seeds, and you have vegetative cover. As soon as you stop the toxicity, windblown seeds become volunteer cover. We always, again, try to get a legume in the mixture. So that's the end of this part of what I'm going to say today. I told you a big story. I think anybody can use these ideas on a zinc toxic, copper toxic, nickel toxic, aluminum toxic, nutrient deficient, severely long-term, barren Superfund site, convert it into a site which is safe for wildlife, safe for hunters and so on, just not a playground. We're not trying to say it's a playground. We're trying to say it's remediated, protects the public interest, protects the private interests around it, stops further dispersal of the contaminants. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rufus. While I'm going to make our transition to our next presenter, we did have a couple questions come in while you were speaking, so maybe you can address those while I'm moving things around in the Adobe Connect room. The first question, the person wants to know, have metals and or sulfate concentrations been measured in the stormwater runoff of any of these amended sites?
The sulfate in the leachate is high, and it's unavoidable because when you have a pyrite site, for instance, it's going to have very, very high levels of sulfate. Yeah, the runoff is not the same kind of problem. The organic matter favors infiltration, so if there's any issue, it's going to be a sulfate leachate question.
Okay, we'll take one other question before we move on to Gary. This person wants to know if they're using fly ash, they're incorporating fly ash into the soil, is the electric conductivity going to be a problem? And their reasoning is thinking that the fly ash contains high concentrations of salt.
If we were applying a very high loading of fly ash, particularly on a western site with already too dry situation, there we'd have to worry about it, take it into account. If you're only using it, some fly ash is high in limestone equivalent and provides part of the phytostabilization chemistry and benefit. In that case, on eastern sites, the salts would not be a problem. Western sites, even the salts in manure compost have to be taken into account. Sometimes we have to use a metal, a salt-tolerant grass for the first couple years so that we can allow natural rainfall to leach some of the salts out of the surface soil. Again, manure and biosolids are saltier than many soils. However, the site that Mike Zimmerman is going to talk about was so high in sulfate from the pyrite oxidation that it was salt toxic as well as zinc toxic. So in that case, by curing the toxicity and making it so that the salt could leach, it no longer became salt tolerant, but the salts did leach.
Okay, great. All right, well, I want to encourage everyone to continue submitting your Q's and A's in the question and answer pod in the Adobe Connect room, and we'll have another break for questions after the next presenter. And thank you very much, Rufus, and we'll hear from you again at the end of our presentation. So our next presenter is Gary Lipsum, and he has served as an on-scene coordinator with EPA Region 1 for the past 25 years, where he's conducted numerous time-critical removal actions and emergency responses in the region. So, Gary, I've given you the presenter rights, and you should be good to go to give your presentation.
All right, very good. Am I coming in all right?
Yes, you sound great.
Okay, good. Thanks, Michelle, and thank you, Dr. Cheney. Well, good morning, good afternoon to you all, depending where you're calling in from. As Michelle said, I've been an EPA on-scene coordinator here in Region 1 for 25 years or so. We cover the six New England states. The revegetation project that I'm about to present a case study on, it was a pilot project conducted at the Vermont Asbestos Group mine site, northern Vermont, about 20 miles south of the Canadian border. I'm going to start off by quickly going through a bit of the site history, which is actually quite fascinating, and the EPA removal action we conducted in 2007 and 2008. From there, we'll segue into what I consider the crux of my presentation, revegetation of land that just doesn't quite seem possible upon first glance. So the approximate 1,500 acre mine property is located in the towns of Lowell and Eden, Vermont. The footprint of the mine itself, all the gray areas you see, approximately 1 square mile or about 640 acres. This property happens to be at the southern end of a large naturally occurring asbestos belt, which reaches well into Canada. It's where they have the really big mines. So asbestos was first discovered on the side of Belvedere Mountain, and this is Mount Belvedere right here. In the late 1800s, and by the time the first quarry was exhausted up here, it left behind an approximate 5 to 6 million ton tailing pile, which is this upper tailing pile you see right here. This was followed by the Lowell Quarry, which is a quarry right here where you see a lake. We'll see another picture of that. And it was called the Sea Cut. And the waste rock from these two quarries formed this bigger pile right here, estimated about 25 million tons. An interesting little sidelight is once this the mining was done in the quarry up top here, they actually constructed a tram that brought the rock uphill to be processed. As far as I know, it's the first time they've ever brought rock uphill to crush it. They had all the process equipment up top here, and prior to building additional processing facility down here, they actually brought it uphill with a tram. So the Vermont Asbestos Group mine at its heyday was probably the most productive chrysotile asbestos mine in the U.S., although, again, still dwarfed by its northern neighbors in Quebec and Canada. The mine closed in 1993 as regulations regarding asbestos use and manufacturing tightened up. Kind of get a scale of the size of this right here at the right here at the bottom, you'll see a seven-story building really dwarfed by the surrounding pile of rock tailings. Since that time, this property has become a real playground for ATVers. It's got a huge network of trails running through here, hunters, hikers, rock and mineral collectors. I've been told that half of the geology department or the Gem Museum at the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont, has rock and minerals from this mine. It's also a big spot for peregrine falcon watchers and fern gatherers, as there's a certain indigenous type of fern that grows up here in the serpentine soils. So here's just another view. This was the known as a Lowell Quarry. This pit was about is about 100 feet deep, where they mine the asbestos rock out of. Just a nice little artsy shot of the some of the abandoned process buildings here. So, in 2006, EPA was approached by the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources to discuss potential agency involvement as the site was beginning to deteriorate. At the time of the closing, I mean, it was a huge property, very steep slopes, not a lot of money to play with, so they could only do so much to close up this mine. It was becoming evident that asbestos-laden sediment was migrating off-site and actually affecting local streams and wetlands in two distinct watersheds. The state tried working with the property owner to stabilize site conditions, but they were not able to afford the huge cost. And in 2007, the state official asked for EPA assistance. What you're seeing actually is a private wetlands down gradient of the site. This is the delta of asbestos-containing tailings and sediment flowing into the private wetlands. This all came to a head when this private landowner that was affected started bringing lawsuits against the mine owner, and that's when it came to our attention. And this is actually a private wetland area. It's a hunting camp that this individual owns. This is the upper tailing pile, the Eden tailing pile, which was the cause of all this sediment and contamination down below. After water went by, left some nice asbestos hanging from the debris. It's just a footprint in the sediment layer. This is a pretty amazing shot. It just shows the amount after rainfall, the amount of sediment and contaminated mine tailings that are washing down. This is a clean tributary coming into it right here, so you could see the difference. So in the fall of 2007 and in the spring of 2008, EPA conducted a removal action at the mine site. As you can see, we try to keep the locals happy by hiring some local help for our decon. Since this total mine cleanup would be in excess of $200 million, and we got that estimate from a mine remediation expert, as we were looking into possible national priority list, a listing of the site. And considering my program, the removal program, has a budget of $2 million by statutory limits, it was evident we'd strictly be applying a Band-Aid to this site. So what we did over the next few months was try to do whatever we can to keep contaminated water and sediment from leaving the site. So that was digging diversion trenches and basins and water bars. What you're seeing here is directly downstream of that upper pile, and we just try to create a series of rock dams and basins to settle out some of the finer sediment. Here's a berm at the base of the large pile. It's just about filled up. This probably has 10 to 12 feet of fine sediment in it already. This, again, at the base of the large pile, what we're doing right here is just building a large basin to try to contain any of the sediment flowing off before it gets to the stream leading off site. We put in a couple of markers just to try to judge how much sediment we were actually collecting. There's another... another shot of that basin, and this, if you could see, is just a large berm right here to try to keep all the sediment and tailings off of the road so we continue to have access to the rest of the mine. This I like to throw in there. We were getting a lot of our rock and material we were trying to work with on-site. This is actually a nice health and safety shot, which has plenty of problems, but bottom line is nobody got hurt in our job. So due to the size of these tailing piles, the steep slopes, the violent weather patterns, and the microclimate up north, it was very obvious that this Band-Aid wouldn't last a long time, just a few years. The site continued to degrade. EPA's contractors began sampling the site and the surroundings to give it a preliminary scoring for inclusion on the national priority list. For a number of reasons, the two affected towns, Eden and Lowell, resoundingly voted to not list the site. And since it's Vermont's policy not to list on the NPL without local support, the site has not yet been proposed or included on the NPL. So Region 1, and the site in particular, offered a pilot study that would attempt to grow sustainable vegetation. This was attractive on a number of fronts in the short term to show that something could actually grow on a barren gray landscape, to show the local population that weren't happy with to begin with, that if the site were to be listed, it would eventually be covered with an attractive green cover material, which, you know, they're just picturing, okay, just all they could see is huge earth-moving machines, clouds of asbestos dust. So it would be nice to show them something could actually be grown there. On the long term, meaning of vegetation, proved to be sustainable and was expanded to eventually cover the site, it would provide stability to the slopes and reduce some of that dust from leaving the site. And maybe the most attractive outcome of this pilot study could eventually lead to huge cost savings. As I mentioned earlier, the low-end cost estimation for full remediation via the National Priority List was in the order of hundreds of millions of dollars. The traditional method of mine site remediation, once you're able to regrade the slopes to get them to reasonable angles, is to lay down, let's say, a minimum of a foot of topsoil to support vegetative growth. By implementing this methodology that we've been discussing, that I'm going to show you a lot more of, the supporting layer of soil and amendments is reduced to maybe 6 inches or less. So you've got a huge cost savings in trucking this material in. Not only mention the amount of topsoil would have to be stripped from another source or manufacturing topsoil to bring in. So not only do you have this economic benefit, you've also got a much reduced carbon footprint from a lot less foot traffic, or I should say truck traffic. So as Dr. Cheney stressed in his presentation, it's really important to conduct lab tests prior to field implementation. You need to work either representative samples of site soil in combination with a number of different plant species and different combination of amendments to determine what the optimal ingredients are. It certainly also helps to have a good working knowledge of soil and plant chemistry. So the way we started off, we collected, I should say, the state of Vermont collected a number of these soil, and I have soil in quotations because it's more of a rock-based matrix, were collected and shipped to Dr. Cheney's USDA laboratory and greenhouse in Maryland. We used 9 different plant species to evaluate the growth in a number of different combinations, strictly the control and fertilizer, addition of compost, and then compost, fertilizer, and gypsum, and then control and topsoil. And here's just a little picture right here. Okay. So why was the fertilizer added? Studies have shown, we've also shown in recent work that Dr. Cheney did, that serpentine soils are highly deficient in phosphorus, calcium, nitrogen, and potassium. He recommended fertilizer for up in that section of the world in northern Vermont is a 1:2:2 ratio of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. All right. And why was compost used? Dr. Cheney mentioned the importance of compost, and I think we all know compost is inherently a good thing for your garden. A lot of us have compost piles in their backyard. Quite a few reasons. It improves your soil structure and your porosity. It reduces erosion and runoff, which is something we're certainly looking for in a site like this, by increasing the moisture infiltration. It holds water. It's got a better water holding capacity. It supplies all sorts of micronutrients. It's a slow release of your important nutrients and minerals. Supplies that we talked about before, the importance of organic matter, supplies beneficial microorganisms, and improves and stabilizes your soil pH. In trying to keep things, keeping the cost down for this pilot study, as well as trying to keep things at a local level, we did go to a Vermont dairy farm locally to get the mature compost of combination manure and yard waste. Why gypsum? It turned out gypsum for this particular type, serpentine soil, extremely important amendment. Studies have shown that the plant roots do not normally penetrate into these kind of subsoil with insufficient calcium. And it's in this case, it's not so much insufficient calcium, but it's a high calcium to magnesium ratio. So we're trying to lower the magnesium and increase the calcium. I think Dr. Cheney also mentioned this. Normal gypsum sold in a pelletized form, but this doesn't allow the dissolution of the calcium to hit the soil as fast as we want it to. Therefore, we looked more at getting a powder gypsum. Again, extremely expensive to get the laboratory grade, so there's an increasingly available gypsum available. From coal-fired power plants known as FGD or flue gas desulfurization substitute, and that should be more and more available in the future. So, as I said, we used a couple of different types of species of plants to see what would take in that particular area, in that particular soil matrix. As you can see, 26 days of India grass doesn't look too good. However, big blue stem looks a little better. You see a different type of the different mixtures of amendments here. You go to Kentucky bluegrass is looking very good after 26 days. The control in gypsum very strong, and this is let's see, from 26 to 47 days, you see extremely nice green and solid growth here. Okay. So you're in the laboratory, and what is Dr. Cheney and his staff doing there? They're preparing all the plots and seeding. Now everything's got SOPs. Everything's carefully measured out and done exactly the same over and over again. They're watering the plants on a regular schedule, observing the responses. About six to eight weeks into the growth, they're harvesting the plant shoots for yield amendment and analyzing them. Shoots are cut off at about 2.5 centimeters. At that time, where they're analyzing those shoots, they're regrowing the plants, continuing to examine the roots, and looking at the depth of the root penetration. Once they've cut off those shoots, they're analyzing, they're drying, weighing, and prepping samples for analysis and looking for the important minerals. You also want to look at the soil, your mine waste, and the amendments being added. You need to analyze them so the effects the amendments can be understood. It's nice to have a working knowledge of your plant chemistry and the soil chemistry to know where this is all going. Also, as it says, analyze for exchangeable nutrients and phytoavailable phosphorus and total nutrients. Okay. Those of you that have worked with Harry Compton, you might recognize him as the gentleman on the right. So we've now taken all the laboratory findings, brought them out to the field. It's a lot of just hand mixing right here. Nothing too scientific about this. Right there, it looked like limestone is being added here, and Dr. Cheney mentioned the importance of limestone to offset the phytotoxic nature of acidic soils. Not only, as he mentioned, do you have the regular acid rain occurring, but when the legumes fix the nitrogen is getting oxidized, generating additional acidity. You don't want your pH getting too low, as we said, because it then becomes phytotoxic and nothing's going to grow there. So limestone was added to all the amendments. Carefully done in the field, again, with written down scope of works. Everything's repeated. Everything's carefully documented as far as what's going in what plot, either blue, red, or white. We do have some control plots. As you can see, I think it's the white ones where we don't have anything growing. Those are control plots. So this is in the summer of 2010. We try to go into some of these slopes just to make sure that it will take on some of the small, steeper slopes. We didn't want to get too high, just knowing the amount of runoff and sediment would be covering some of these plots. And so we're just trying to see if it grew year after year as opposed to making sure they didn't get buried in sediment. So later that summer, in September of 2010, we started getting nice growth. It's become apparent that it was taking. Another couple of shots, you'll see a couple of different species, some clover coming up in there along with the grasses. Again, you'll see the different color flags just telling you what was planted in each spot. As expected, the control was growing nothing or next to nothing. So that was certainly expected. So in the following summer in 2011, there's a few members of Dr. Cheney's staff here came up from Maryland to look at the plants and collect samples in the field. The gentleman in the middle is John Schmelzer with the state of Vermont, who was very instrumental in getting this project to go. And again, everything's being done very carefully with standard operating procedures. So everything's repeated exactly the same. This is all documented, all written down with step-by-step directions. You can see a cross-section. Even this, the way this was dug out is very regimented, so it could be repeated. Looking at this next one, I believe it's showing, I don't know if you can see that in your slide, but you could see this little thread of a root coming down here about 9 inches below the top layer, which is amazing considering the matrix of the soil. So clearly the calcium was helping to root this plant. So now we're talking 2 years later, and so far so good, beautiful, green, and lush. You can see how it stands out to the surrounding gray soil. Again, some different species coming up, some clover mixed in with the grasses, looking very strong. This was just taken a week or so ago, so knowing that we have such an incredibly long winter in northern Vermont, you could just barely, if you look close, see some little green popping through, so I would guarantee this is not dead. This is just starting to get into its growing stages for the year. And again, these are the plots just taken a week ago or so. So big question, anybody can plant something in topsoil. It could grow for the first season, but the big question here is this going to last? We think so because you've got organic matter routinely deposited. As you get your yearly growth and death cycles, the plant material is being deposited. Your legumes or the clover contain bacteria producing nitrogen. That continuous source of nitrogen is helping to fertilize the soil. And then with the compost and fertilizer, you get a slow release of your minerals, your nitrogen, phosphorus, zinc, and copper. Okay. And why was this pilot project successful? As Dr. Cheney said, you can't skip the lab work. The soil matrix was first evaluated for metals, pH, and nutrients, not only what was there, but what was missing. The prior knowledge, a lot of studies been done over the years, that serpentine soils are severely deficient, calcium and phosphorus, and the tailor-made amendments. You're working in the laboratory to see what works and then taking that into the field. You're just not experimenting when you're out there in the field. So you're mixing your amendments to try to get your best growth in a nice controlled setting, a laboratory / greenhouse. And you need that amendment mixture for all the nutrients to help grow in the compost. As was said earlier, the limestone was a key component. Otherwise, you're going to get that phytotoxic layer of acidification. So the limestone is a key ingredient. The gypsum, and hopefully getting inexpensive as time goes by, to boost the calcium in the subsurface soil. and state and local acceptance. This, in this particular case, this was just a pilot study, so there wasn't a lot of local awareness of what was going on. Certainly, if this were to go in the NPL and this was were to become a viable cover material for the site, you know, this would go a long way in getting local acceptance. So all in all, successful. If the towns ever ever change their train of thought and this does eventually list on national priority list, I think we'll have a head start on how we could grow vegetated cover here. And many thanks to Dr. Cheney and his staff at the Agriculture Research Service Laboratory in Maryland, Harry and Stephen with ERT, Michelle and Ellen with the Technology Assessment Branch, and my friends with the state of Vermont, John Schmelzer and Linda Elliott. So thank you.
Great. Thanks, Gary. Loved all those pictures. It's pretty incredible. We got a question, and I'm not sure, Gary, if you want to answer this, or we have Dr. Cheney answer it, but it's just a question about, so we're vegetating these soils and we're growing these plants. What kinds of concentrations of the metals are we seeing in the plants, and what are you doing to measure those heavy metal concentrations?
Actually, I don't have any of that information offhand. Dr. Cheney, I don't know if you know any of that off the top of your head.
Rufus, feel free to take your phone off mute. Okay, well, maybe he had to step out for a moment.
Okay.
And we can get back to that. In the meantime, if anyone has any questions that they would like to pose to Gary, please submit them in the Q&A pod in the bottom right-hand corner of the Adobe Connect room, and we'll have Gary answer your questions. At this point, I'm going to start moving over the presentation rights to our next presenter. And if Rufus, if you get back online and want to help us answer this question about heavy metal concentrations in plants, we can certainly do that, or maybe we'll have time at the end to do that.
Am I on now?
Yes. Hi, Rufus.
Yeah, hi.
Did you hear the question?
I did. We analyzed, of course, the plants from the greenhouse experiment, but also from the field. The plants were absolutely and not anywhere near a toxic concentration of any element. They were normal composition for grass and legume plants. They would be very nutritious for wildlife. Again, there's no toxicity and no deficiency after we've done those amendments.
Okay, great. Great, and again, I would just encourage all of our participants to just submit your questions as we're going through the next presentation, so that way we're ready to answer them when we get to the Q&A portion at the end. So thanks, Gary. I really enjoyed your presentation. I think it was a good complement to the introduction from Dr. Cheney, as I believe our next presenter will also complement all of this well. We have Mike Zimmerman, and Mike has 26 years of experience as an on-scene coordinator with EPA. He's in Region 8. He's worked on projects involving PCP incineration, oil pipelines, ammonium nitrate stabilization, detonation, fluvial tailings bioremediation, which we're going to hear about today, leaking underground storage tanks, abandoned fuel tank farms, mercury spills, cyanide spills, ammonia releases, and several waste paint drum removals. So, Mike, we're very excited for your presentation. I've given you presenter rights, and you should have everything you need.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, everybody. The first two presentations were excellent. They're kind of hard acts to follow, but I hope folks will stay tuned. We do have some interesting information to present here. We became involved with the Superfund program removal on the California Gulch NPL site in 1996, and we had one of the operable unit number 11, that was highly contaminated and that abutted the Arkansas River. For those that may not be familiar with the California Gulch Superfund site, it originates in Leadville, Colorado. Mining back there goes back to the mid-1800s. They had a gold rush there. As you can see the slide there, it indicates that it's kind of a hodgepodge of residential areas with mining, mines and mills and all kinds of waste debris throughout the community. As you could expect, a lot of contaminated material was produced, and over the years, well, the Leadville site has produced, this is a 1967 figure, but it produced over $7 billion or $5 billion in gold, silver, lead, copper, and zinc ores. So at one time, it was the richest silver mining area in the world. So it has a mining history that's kind of hard to live down, but today we're kind of contending with the remnants from that particular mining activity. Leadville, Colorado, I don't know how many of you have been to the high mountains in Colorado. Leadville sits at 10,165 feet. It's almost at tree line. It's about 5 miles away from the Continental Divide. Waters that fall on the western side of the divide go to the Pacific Ocean. On the east side, it goes to the Gulf of Mexico by the way of the Arkansas River and the Mississippi River. So the development started on the south side of Leadville over in the this particular we're on the west side of town, southwest side of town, and it was called Oro City, but eventually Leadville overtook it. The gold rush lasted until approximately 1874, but after that, the miners discovered a gray mineral. And through some assay experiments, they determined that it was silver. So silver mining took off about 1874, and it continued on for several years. I think active mining in Leadville lasted over 130 years. You may have heard of the Baby Doe Mine, which was owned by John and Molly Brown. Molly Brown was on the Titanic when it went down, and brought a lot of recognition to the Leadville community. Maybe I mentioned it, but at one time, 40,000 people lived in the immediate Leadville area. So also, there were many mines there. Additionally, there was an individual by the name of Guggenheim that owned a mine in the area. And he went on to found the Asarco smelting operation that we know of today that has a lot of sites around the country. So with this historic mining activity, you can imagine what storm events would do as the snow melt, rains came, why you would get a lot of downstream migration of the deposits. This is the confluence of California Gulch and the Arkansas River. Over to the right, you can see the influence of the deposits as they come down California Gulch and they intersect with the Arkansas River. So naturally, you have high turbidity there, but naturally you also have a lot of heavy metals and a lot of undesirable impacts to the Arkansas River. So, and moving on, the Arkansas River extends for approximately several hundred miles. It goes through southern Colorado on into Kansas and intercepts the Mississippi River in lower Arkansas. This is an aerial view of the Arkansas River OU-11. That is the operable unit number. It's interesting that it also matches the number of miles of the operable unit, which happens to be 11. So the upper reach, the upper 9-mile reach of it is the area that we are primarily concerned with. There are approximately over 300 acres of irrigated meadows to contend with, 65 acres of fluvial tailings or floodplain tailings, and over 300 acres of riparian areas to recondition. So another aerial view of the Arkansas River. You can see all the tributaries, all the abraded stream beds, etc. You can also see the deposits in the fluvial tailings there. Just to the right, you will see an area that's somewhat blighted. That's an area known as irrigated pastures or plains. The ranchers in this area would use the waters out of the Arkansas River to irrigate their pastures. Unfortunately, the waters contained heavy metals. And over time, probably 80 to 100 years, why the irrigated pastures became contaminated. So that's why you'll see blighting of the contaminated irrigated pastures. Moving on, today we wanted to talk about fluvial tailings. This is a shot of a highly contaminated area along the floodplain. You notice that we have logs and tree debris, almost anything. We had tires, almost anything that floated down during flood events would end up in the fluvial tailings. The theory is that there was enough velocity behind the water to carry the material down into the lower reaches of the Arkansas River, but then once the water lost its velocity, it also lost its load. So you see a great deal of deposits in this area, some of them as thick as 4 feet. This is what the Arkansas River looks like during spring runoff. You can see the high turbidity levels. A lot of this washes down from California Gulch by Leadville. Also, during spring runoff, snowmelt, you'll get a lot of conditions similar to this. Also, the Bureau of Reclamation manages a reservoir just north of the OU-11 called Turquoise Reservoir, and at times they release large quantities of water, which when mixed with the tailings along the river, you get these kind of conditions again. And it's very adverse to the river, adverse to the pasture lands, and particularly fishing in that along the Arkansas. So the remedial program approached removal, and we established some criteria and objectives that we were going to try and address, limit human exposure to unacceptable levels of metals, try and reduce the erosion of the fluvial waste into the river, try and control infiltration of metals into the groundwater, reduce plant uptake of metals, and improve plant diversity, which I believe we will show you later on. We had pretty good success there thanks to Rufus Cheney, Dr. Sally Brown and Harry Compton. It was a very successful project. And then also you have the specter of attractive nuisance. The wildlife would consume the vegetation. Would they also experience uptake also? So the summary of alternatives for the 11-mile reach, we had several areas to treat and treat with different applications, the irrigated meadows or pastures, fluvial mine waste, and the riparian areas. And you can see there's quite a few acres there, over almost 700 acres or so. But the alternatives that we considered were no further action, which is kind of a benign thought if we're going to try and improve the conditions, why that really wasn't a preferred alternative. One of the stake owners proposed soil amendments and vegetative cover, or one of the landowners suggested that we regrow some soil along the river. So that was one of the approaches that eventually came about. Okay, then we also have the alternative of excavation and disposal of highly metallized soils. And I might mention at this point that at Harry Compton's direction, we did a cost comparison of our project that you'll see versus what it would cost to excavate, dispose, backfill with clean soils, and then revegetate. And the cost comparison came out very favorable to the alternative that we chose later on. The costs were in the neighborhood with savings of 10 to 1. We estimated that it would cost $22 million to treat the areas by excavation and disposal versus about $2 million for the route that we finally accepted their soil amendments. So let me move on here. Okay, here's another shot of the river. The areas to the right are irrigated meadows, and you can see there's a lot to be treated. There's area A and area B along the river. We have overlapping fluvial tailings and riparian areas to treat. But for the fluvial tailings, you can see the four approaches that were identified. And only the second alternative was really feasible. Another shot of the riparian areas that overlapped to a great degree with the fluvial tailings. And so during the evaluation process, we had to consider overall protection, ARRs, which is a subject into itself. You have to consider all the state and local applicable regulations, laws, guidelines. What type of long-term effectiveness do we have? Rufus went into a lot of those discussion in his presentation. We also have the treatment of high metal soils, short-term effectiveness, which we did have later on. We had some initial growing pains, which we'll discuss. Is it implementable? It kind of turns out to be a construction project. I've talked about the cost, $22 million of dig and haul versus $2 million for reconditioning of the soils. You have to have stakeholder acceptance and community acceptance, and I'll talk about those during the recap. But for the fluvial tailings, the choice of Harry Compton and ERT, Sally Brown was very instrumental in setting up the recipe for this project. So The Arkansas River lies in a valley that is adjacent to what we call the Collegiate Peaks within Colorado. On the west side is, like I say, the drainage to the Pacific Ocean. On the east side, we go to the Arkansas River, the Mississippi River, and onto the Gulf of Mexico. We have very adverse growing conditions. If we're going to recondition the soils with vegetation, there's about a 60-day growing period. It's not uncommon for it to snow in July. One particular August, we only had 4 days in which in the valley there in which it did not freeze. So it takes several years to develop a vegetative cover. But so this is our mother load of contaminated materials. You can see that there isn't much promise here to start with. A lot of these logs and timbers floated down. We think when a bulkhead gave loose up in Leadville, we were informed that at one time the Arkansas River ran a red color all the way to Pueblo after a huge bulkhead implosion, and that's a distance of about 140 miles. So as the waters recede, slow down, you get the deposition of a lot of heavy metals. This particular area had surface salts in the neighborhood of 10%. I think it was the concentration was 115,000 parts per million. Actually, you can take a view from one of the local mountains, and this zinc flat can be seen from a distance of 20 miles. It looks like a snowfield. But you can imagine what happens to the aquatic life when you get a storm event, weather event, all the zinc salts wash off into the river. It's very hard on aquatic life, not just the fish, but on all the microorganisms that they live on. You also, it's not very shown very well in this slide, but you get a lot of frost heaving where the contaminants they'll become mounded as the freezing and thawing mechanism affects them differently. You can see right on the surface we have a lot of zinc salts that have precipitated through wicking action. And during dry periods of time, the wicking seems to be more pronounced as water is drawn to the surface by the sun. It's a very warm atmosphere, say noonday up in the summertime along the river. Adjacent to the river, we also have some very high concentrations of toxic water. This is an area that had a pH of 1. It looks like cherry coke. The soil pHs in this area were 2.3 to 4.5. So you can imagine some of the adverse conditions we had to work with. We didn't address calving of embankments initially, but we discovered that as storm events take place, the stream banks become laden with water. Some 3 or 4 feet of tailings deposits here. But as the water recedes, Mr. Gravity takes over, and the embankments spall off into the river. And this releases a lot of heavy metals into the water column. And as you can see by this next picture, there's a little more dramatic presentation. You can see over to the right, a large embankment did spall off. At one time, during the worst conditions, Brown trout did not exist in this particular reach of the river. It's improved considerably. So for the fluvial tailings, so just from field observations, you had a lot of cut banks to deal with, surface salts and standing waters of high, of low pH to deal with. What kind of concentrations of heavy metals do we have using XRF sampling, field sampling? Cadmium was very high, 1,100, copper 7,800 ppm. Lead, we had one concentration up to 50,000, manganese 33,000, and zinc above 10%. The thought was with the zinc concentrations, we could collect that, add a little Vaseline, and then we would have zinc oxide for any of our physical ailments. So anyway, we moved on to what the remedy might be. Sally Brown was very instrumental in working with Denver Metro to provide a large source of organic amendments. You can see the steaming biosolids here. We did have some complaints about the odor, but that was quickly dissipated over a week or so. And over to the right, you can see some of our stockpiled lime. Denver Metro, I don't know if it shows it here. Denver Metro did supply 4,600 wet tons of biosolids for application on the initial 5 acres of fluvial tailings. The application rate that we used was 100 dry tons of biosolids per acre plus 100 tons of ag lime per acre. Here the high load operator is mixing the two into hopefully a homogeneous mixture. That wasn't always the case, and we'll show you a solution to that later on. But once adequately mixed, the operator would load it into what we call a terrigator that was provided by Denver Metro. We had approximately 150 loads provided by Denver Metro. That was provided free of charge. However, we did have to pay for the trucking, which turned out to be about $25,000. It's 110 miles from the plant here in Denver to the Arkansas Valley. So, and we got by without any accidents, which we put that in our risk assessment. But anyway, this is Terrigator as he's moving around, applying the biosolids from 8-inch depth to anywhere up to 18 inches. Now, keep in mind, this material is 84% water and only 14% biosolids. And so we tried to incorporate the material into the soil using an industrial tractor and disc. Now, Denver Metro applies their biosolids to wheat fields in eastern Colorado, where the application is just a few inches, not 8 to 18 inches like we're dealing with here. So they have very good success with a thin layer of biosolids, but when we get into depths of several inches up to a foot, foot and a half, the industrial tractor really had some traction problems, as you might surmise. We used an industrial disc for incorporation, and you can see that this material is really pretty soupy, 84% water. Later on, we a demonstration project, we incorporated biosolids pellets, lime, and this was the incorporation was much easier. We acquired the biosolids pellets from the city of Boston, Had them conveyed out here by way of train, way of a train. And then we applied it in piles on the plots in the lime. And then we had a caterpillar level the field and then try and incorporate it by using its blade. We tried to use MIT pellets. We thought that would increase it's kind of a smart bomb. We thought that would increase our intelligent approach to the project. Bad material, right, folks? Okay, on another project, like the third demonstration project, we went to compost and lime and applied the material. The compost has a very high water retention value, and we felt that was very important in such a dry climate. And we got a little better response with that than we did with some of the other organic amendments. And here again, we used a cat with a blade on it for incorporation. We'll show you a lot better method here in a little bit. Ah, here it is. Okay, Michelle, can you activate the
Is it?
No, it's not running yet. Michelle, oh, there you go. Okay, this was purchased at about $150,000 by Pacific Western contractor, remedial contractor, and this is probably the best source of incorporation. You apply the material based upon the recipe for activation training, your compost or your organic component, and then you use the track hole, which has a special bucket on it, and it can handle up to 12-inch boulders and rocks. So it's an excellent means to incorporate. Again, yeah, very homogeneous mixture. That way you can be sure that you can incorporate the material at depth. I think this can work up to 4 feet. So a lot of the riparian areas under the remedial program use this particular type of incorporation. It seems a little costly, but the long-term improvements and impacts to the river a godsend. Okay. All right.
Okay, you should be able to move on from here.
All right, okay. Seeding. Initially, we tried to hand seed the first demonstration project in mid-October of 1999, and what we discovered was that the biosolids were off-gassing ammonia to the extent that it sterilized the seed. So we had a barren crop the first year around, the thought being that the seeds will germinate and flourish with springtime moistures. So our next approach was to hydroseed the fluvial tailings after they've been amended. And in some cases, this is an area that's just been seeded. That was fairly cost effective. Later on, the remedial program used drill seeding, and they felt that was a little bit more successful. But during one of the droughts, I think this was 1999, and also in 2002, we resorted to irrigation because the fluvial tailings were very dry, and we were experiencing a lot of vegetation kill-off. And so we irrigated. We purchased water from the city of Pueblo. I think we purchased like 20 acre feet of water for about $45, which is pretty cost effective. and it turned out pretty successful here. You can see the grasses that have grown up. I think this is probably year two, 1999 to 2000. A lot of the material or seeding that we relied on, native mixes. we tried to utilize seeding that the local communities would accept. We didn't want to bring anything in from the outside that would be invasive, and so we used a lot of this is mostly annual rye, but wiregrass, sedges, let me see, and other grasses that were native to the area. Now, annual rye grass, which we only got a one-year growth out of, it takes off very well, but then it'll die out year two, three, and four on, but then the other grasses, the native grasses that you plant will come on and provide you with a good cover. Here you can see the areas that have been revegetated around the confluence. They turned out very well. We had some concentrations of metals in this area. I think zinc was in the thousands of parts per million. And this on here's the confluence of the Arkansas. This picture is taken in late fall. You can see how much growth we got out of the annual rye in 1 year or one brief summer. Now the nitrogen in the biosolids provided a lot of biomass and very good plant cover, good erosion protection. And as time goes along, as you can see in this slide, you get a lot of diversity as the other plants start to develop after the annual rye dies out. In the center, you can see clover, and that's a good sign. So one item that we wanted to also emphasize in working with River Environ that to take care of the spalling banks, etc., we use 3 to 4 foot riprap along the stream banks to prevent calving of the deposits into the river. And then another item that we utilized, you may see in the foreground here, bendway weirs. Now these are 3 to 4 foot riprap boulders that are placed into the river. This water depth is about 4 feet deep. Anyway, they're arched upstream from bank to bank, sort of like a McDonald's golden arches. And the water, from a hydraulic standpoint, across at a 90-degree angle, it tends to deflect the flow out into the center line of the stream. And that keeps the pressure off the banks, and which hopefully will prevent more caving of deposits into the river. And we use this fairly extensively. And the state game and fish really like this idea, along with this particular item right here. using old dead tree roots from really large trees, root wads, we anchored those into the side of the river on the banks, and it provided stabilization of the deposits, plus also provided a great habitat for fish. And this particular area now it has become a favorite fishery for many people. It's got an abundant community of brown trout in this area, so it worked out very well. So I just wanted to wrap up with a few items. And that community acceptance, the type of the way you approach the outside world is really important here. many of the agencies and stakeholders have different agendas. So going into, and Gary probably found this to be true, going into a project like this, the earlier you can find out what the various agendas are for the different groups, the better off you'll be. There are many people that may be adverse to your participation. They will unfortunately make your challenges a little bit more difficult. Particularly working with the state and federal stakeholders, just to have good buy-in from them will go a long ways in providing a successful route to your project. It was a very entertaining project, and eventually the mining company called Resurrection came forward under an enforcement order and reimbursed the government for their expenses. I think restoration in this area ran about $2 million, including the riparian areas and some of the irrigated meadows. I think the federal government was able to recoup over $4 million in costs. So it was a very successful project. So with that, I'd like to compliment again, Harry Compton, Dr. Sally Brown, Dr. Rufus Cheney, and one individual that is not here today. I don't think she's on the line, but one of the contractors for the START contract here in the Denver Region 8 EPA, Jan Christner, did an enormous amount of work to make this project successful. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Michelle.
Great. Thanks, Mike. We did get a question that came in while you were speaking, and it's I think maybe a follow-up to an earlier question we got. This participant is really interested in knowing about the mobility of the metals, I guess, once you do the treatment with the organic amendments, and particularly if there's stormwater runoff. And I guess this person is curious if there's been any like stormwater measured for metals, maybe after a stormwater event. I know, Mike, you had mentioned that there was a lot of contamination from the Leadville site prior to any of the remediation happening, and I'm just curious if perhaps you looked at this after the remediation.
You know, I don't recall any stormwater studies per se, but this type of approach will definitely reduce the effects of heavy metals. There were earthworm studies that were conducted, and we went from zero survivability to 78% survivability with the earthworms, and also with native grasses, from zero to almost 100% survivability. I mean, the amendments, lime, they take the metals out of solution and give you a functional soil horizon to grow vegetation.
Okay, great.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, very much. We are coming up close to the end time of our seminar, but we do have a few closing statements from Rufus Cheney. So, Rufus, I've brought your slides up, and if you want to give us some closing.
Okay. As I said during my talk, we think that this use of natural materials, of composts and biosolids and manures, coupled with limestone where it's needed, gypsum where it's needed, and any other the soil amendment that's needed to give the mixture the properties it needs to achieve the remediation goal. The analysis tells you how to meet that goal with the things. And so each one of these sites you've seen had one or more of these problems. It had severe acidity from pyrite oxidation, which made the metal soluble, which made it toxic as all get out. Nutrient deficiencies, every one of them was phosphorus and nitrogen deficient. The Vermont site was extremely calcium deficient. Nothing could grow at all. And without microbes, without soil organic matter, and the turning over of that by bacteria, there just was not a living system there to support plant or microbes or other soil organisms. The solutions are this tailor-made remediation mixture, combining locally available resources. If they're composted, it's better because you conserve more of the nitrogen. We even think you can put together a composting program, a very low-cost on-site composting program with yard debris or shredded wood coupled with manure or biosolids. And when those are then applied, if you mix lime, you can, like Mike showed, you can mix the lime with either the front-end loader or with the machine he showed. And by doing these, you alleviate all of the toxicities, including, because of the phosphate, the potential risk of the lead because it becomes a pyromorphite, a lead-insoluble compound. The lack of toxicity and the available phosphorus lets legumes thrive, which means it becomes a natural, keeping itself fertile, vegetated area. And this, again, it can be done anywhere, everywhere that we've seen it tried. This is being used in Europe at a number, in three or four countries already, besides the extensive program in Poland, using the very techniques that we talked about here that we've shown that they work in the United States. The beauty to me is that it's a one-shot, do it, and it is fixed. You have to take into account any pyrite that's left in the soil and apply enough limestone to neutralize anything that would oxidize in the future. But that's something you can do with a laboratory measurement and then just mix enough limestone in. It may be, in that most extreme case, like Mike showed, it may be 100 tons per acre of limestone, extraordinary application rate. But compared to dig and haul, this is throwaway money. So I think any engineering firm can work with agronomists and soil testing labs from the agricultural side as well as the environmental side and figure out how to apply these concepts anywhere in the United States. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. I want to thank all of our presenters today, Harry Compton, Rufus Cheney, Gary Lipson, and Mike Zimmerman. It was a really wonderful presentation, and I really enjoyed putting this on with you. I do have a few closing slides for our participants, just to let you know about other things that we offer at cluin.org. We have these many ways in which you can connect with us at our website, cluin.org. We're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. So if these are communication tools that you use, I would recommend that you check out our pages and follow us on using those tools. I would also like to direct you to our additional resources that are associated with this webinar. You can click to that from this slide or also under the related URLs pod on the right-hand side. And then I'd also really encourage everyone to just take a moment and complete our feedback form because we do read the feedback and we actually compile your comments and get a lot of ideas for future webinars that we do. So I would highly recommend you do that. It's very useful for us in trying to meet your needs and the kind of things you'd like to hear in the future. So with that, I, again, thank all of our speakers, our participants, for your attention, and this is the official closing of today's webinar. Thank you all very much.